Hear you.
Awesome.
You can
Thank you
start
so
again.
much. Thanks to all of you for inviting me to come speak today about our program, Straw, and I'm here at Point Blue. And just wanted to also huge gratitude to the Restoration Bay Authority because as we were one of the original grantees to receive funds from the first round, and we're about wrapping up our first round of work together. It's just been really fun to reflect on it, thinking through this presentation as well. One last little thing, I was hoping to be there in person, but I ended up having to be on Zoom, and I'm thank goodness because the flu that's going through my community is getting me right now too. So I apologize if I'm a little bit scratchy, but I'm glad I'm not there in person, bringing this with me. So next slide, please. I'm the restoration director for the Students and Teachers Restoring a Watershed program at Point Blue Conservation Science. And we've been doing habitat restoration with community for the last 30 years. And today we're going to talk about kind of different components of our work, and especially relative to the funding from the Restoration Authority around the wetland-upland transition zone habitat type. Next slide, please. So just a quick outline for those of you that aren't familiar, I'll talk about Point Blue and our history with the Straw Program, and then primarily focus on our approach to community involvement in restoration and restoration design, establishment, and monitoring. It's pretty interesting, the previous discussions and presentations, interesting to hear that the different concepts that are rolling around in the advisory boards world around monitoring and project performance and proportional access to these projects for different communities. I really appreciate the intention and thought that I heard in those previous discussions. So thank you. Next slide. Just to kick it off, and yes, I've been partial and been doing this work for a long time, but restoration definitely works. So as we're grappling through all the different mechanisms to make it happen, just wanted to share that we know restoration works on lots of different levels. Visually, at least at the project level for sure. Visually, we see this great transition when projects are done effectively and well. Next slide. The data supports it. This is just one example of change in bird species density and both individual species density as well as species density of variety. And just over the course of 5 years, the big uptick in that diversity and numbers of birds from restoration projects. Birds are wonderful indicators in that they respond quickly to these actions, and they time and again, the data strongly shows a huge correlation of how effective it is. The next slide. And then the last one, just something having been at this for a while, are just really fired up and appreciating how much it's extending into the international stage. And just that restoration now is a part of the conversation of adapting to global climate change challenges, which hasn't always been the case. And just really humbling to be part of the Bay Area restoration community for so long, as I'm sure y'all know, but we have been innovators in this space at this international level for a long time, taking risks, trying things, and setting up programs like the Restoration Authority to make this kind of stuff happen at a regional scale. So just want to appreciate that out loud as well. Okay, so next slide. So just quickly, Point Blue, we've been around since 1965, originally as a Point Reyes Bird Observatory. And our mission is we work to advance the conservation of birds, other wildlife, and ecosystems through science, partnerships, restoration, and outreach. We work to reduce the impacts of climate change, habitat loss, and other environmental threats while developing nature-based solutions to benefit both people in our communities and wildlife. And just a little more information, there's about 160 of us working up and down the Pacific Flyway from Alaska to Antarctica. Our main office is in Petaluma, and as science is at the core of what we do and putting that science into action. Next slide. Okay, so a little hard to do this over Zoom, but is anybody familiar with this creature? Any hands? People want to pop up or anything? No
Yes.
pressure.
Yeah, freshwater
I see a
shrimp.
few on the screen. It's kind of hard for me to see, but awesome. So that's our California freshwater shrimp. And I put this slide up here just to give a quick kind of summary of the history of our Straw program. This freshwater shrimp is endemic, currently known to be in 23 streams in the entire world. And they are all streams draining in sort of the North Bay, section of the San Francisco Bay, heavily endangered and a very small populations left. And it's this creature that started the Straw Program. And kind of a fun story, back in 92, California back then, California Fish and Game had adopted a species program. And the choices in the North Bay area were coho salmon, steelhead trout, and the California freshwater shrimp. And a class in San Anselmo, California, Lorette Rogers was teaching there at the time, chose to adopt the shrimp because no one else did. They felt kind of bad for it, and it wasn't quite as charismatic. That was an era of project-based learning in the public school system, which unfortunately has been coming back in the more recent years. And the fourth graders under Lorette's, you know, leadership, they formed committees, they raised $200,000, and they started looking out for populations or areas where known shrimp populations were and where they could help, because the fundamental question was loss of habitat. They ended up engaging with a group of agricultural landowners out in West Sonoma County along Stemple Creek, who were working to do restoration along their streams to avoid regulatory action, and that Stemple Creek had some elevated ammonia, sediment, and other issues. And they convinced landowners, this group of fourth graders convinced the landowners, the Martin family in particular, to do a restoration on their property to meet those shared goals of, you know, water quality improvement, habitat improvement, and keep, you know, agricultural productive. And that one restoration just snowballed and sort of catalyzed this whole work that we are doing now. And for lots of reasons, engaging different kinds of community members with a shared goal of improving landscape health, questions being asked across groups that otherwise would maybe a little more adversarial, agriculture, environmentalism, suburban, rural communities, and kind of the student involvement and their curiosity and honest questions really kind of helped break down some of the more divisive relationships to lead to working together to get work done. And so that's how we started. And from that one class, I'll show a slide in a minute, we've grown to where we are today. So next slide. As that program was kicking off, it was called the California Freshwater Shrimp Club. Main goals were set, and there are five main goals. And I just noticed that bulleting here didn't work well. They're all one, but that's actually kind of cool because they are of an equal value. So that maybe was subconsciously intentional. But our goals are to empower students, to support teachers, to provide education, to reconnect communities, and to restore the environment. And next, we're going to talk about what that looks like in a few different ways. So next slide. And from that initial class, focusing on those goals, this is where we are today. Worked with over 40,000 students, 10,000 volunteers. Actually, this slide's a little bit old now. We're at over 700 restorations and 35 miles of riparian habitat. That's actually over 40 as well. And over 9 acres of marsh and upland transition zone now as well. And that all started from a simple question of students who wanted to get involved and the willingness and openness of all different kinds of communities to engage in that work and those questions. So next slide. So to kick it off, just want to focus a little bit on ways we engage students in community-based restoration and first talk about K-12. And this is just kind of a fun quote that really kind of still inspires us, even though this is, I think, 28 years old, this quote. I think this project changed everything I thought we could do. I always thought kids meant nothing. I feel that it did show me that kids can make a difference in the world and that we are not just little dots. And so how do we support that feeling? So next slide. For us currently, we really like to operate and really believe in the concept of culturally relevant teaching. And this type of education uses the cultural knowledge, prior experiences, frames of reference, and performance styles of ethnically diverse students to make learning more relevant and effective. And that's a couple ways, what does that look like in the classroom as we're preparing kids for restoration? So next slide. One key component is embracing diverse learning behaviors, not only, you know, classic, you know, reading and oral instruction, kinesthetic, art, physical, auditory, all different ways we can engage students in their learning around watershed health and the importance of habitat restoration, ensuring we have components of that in all of our work so that we're as accessible as possible to different learning styles and different students. And next slide. Bilingual education and getting past the language barrier, you know, so we're able to provide instruction that's accessible and understandable for all the communities we serve in the STRAW program. And so ensuring that we always have educators on hand that can communicate in languages that are most effective for the different communities we serve. Next slide. Chaperone circles. So when we're out on restoration days, we really, really encourage as many chaperones as possible to come out and support the work of the students. And some really important components of that are beyond just having extra hands to, you know, ensure safety and quality work, is to bring an intergenerational approach and support to it all. Bring an experience that's relevant and important for both younger and older people, and bringing that kind of connection at home so they can share what's happened, you know, both as, you know, adults or children, and creates, you know, helps to support bones that are more environmentally cautious or conscious and can see their relevance, whether what a student can do or whether an adult can do as well. And do all of our circles in both Spanish and English so that it's accessible not only to students, but to different chaperones that are able to come as well. Next slide. And then beyond working with our students in that way, prior to coming out to restorations, we do a lot of professional development for our teachers. Currently work with a little over 170 teachers in our network. And a couple key reasons why we do this is teachers are experts, not always maybe valued in our society as should be, but teachers very much know what they were doing or they are doing. They get to spend 180 days with students. So as much as we get to have visits with our with students, both in the class and the field, there's just not nearly as much time as teachers are able to. So the more we can support their learning and interest and curiosity around environmental science and conservation, the better they can apply that to their classrooms. And as important or most importantly, they know their communities better than anyone. So the more we support their knowledge and support them translating that in a way that's most effective for their learners, the better. So that's a reason we focus so much on professional development for our teachers as well. So next slide. And then currently also just want to chat a little bit about our approach to learners that are after high school, kind of early career people, you know, from the 18 to 22, 24 age range. And one interesting silver lining I'd like to pause from the pandemic is with our Measure AA funding, as you can imagine, especially last couple years, our ability to work with students in the field was severely limited. We fortunately were still able to do some, but not to the capacity that we were used to. At the same time, we had a pilot program going around supporting community college students in the environmental kind of careers and industry. And with all this, you know, wonderful collaboration with Restoration Authority staff, Natasha Dunn, who's our program manager, who is a stellar individual. We, you know, we talked about, well, what are the ways we can get community involved in projects as the pandemic was moving on and the regulations were not allowing traditional field trips to happen? It was an opportunity to scale this program up. And our community college conservation internship has three main goals. And that's learn the theory behind and practices in environmental science, create a practice of self-awareness and critical thinking to navigate the predominantly white environmental field as BIPOC individuals, and to create a sense of belonging and build a supportive community. So next slide. And just a quick infographic just to illustrate, you know, there's a huge disparity and lack of people of color in the conservation community, conservation industry in general, and in particular, as you move through more permanent positions. And, you know, foundations are close to representing the diversity we have in our, you know, greater Bay Area. But other industries, you know, as when you move beyond foundations, you get to government agencies and NGOs, it's not even remotely close to representing the, you know, the wonderful diversity that we have. So that was a big driver for us to look at community college program as a way to help move the needle here and have better representation in the environmental career industry. So next slide. And why we started working with community college student population was under the leadership of Alba Estrada, who is our former Roger Ainger Young Fellow here at Point Blue, who's been studying the interplay of, you know, access to environmental careers and you know, upper education. And her experience as well was just finding that, you know, community college students represent 40% of all undergraduates across the country. And so in the United States, that's 6 million students. In California, that's 2. So in California, that's 68% of all students in higher education. And community college student population are primarily 2/3 of them are people of color and are of low socioeconomic status. So to bring a program to a community college in a way that was authentic and accessible and created that space for people to explore environmental careers was something that, you know, we felt would be a great way to meet our goal to bring more diversity into environmental movement. So next slide. And so what that looks like for us is we have a 10-week internship program, combination of virtual and field visits, especially now we're able to get out in the field more. It happens weekly over the summer, over those 10 weeks, with both webinars and field visits. And from there, the students that are interested can move into an apprenticeship that's full-time or part-time to allow for different schedules and different needs outside of their, you know, education and workday. And a length that's pretty flexible, anywhere from a semester to up to 11 months at this point. And so that's just the approach now that's really taking off for our work. And Measure AA was a catalyst for us to move that from pilot into reality and scale it to adapt to the pandemic's impact on our ability to work with K-12 students. So next slide. Thank you. So the rest of the presentation, I was asked to focus on the sort of the restoration practice of our work. So that's what we'll be focusing on here. And the general concept we operate under is this idea of climate smart restoration, you know, which is innovative and empowering approach to restoration and environmental and social justice. And the reason that is it's not only looking at the scientific practices of project design, implementation, maintenance, adaptive management, it's just how you engage community in all those different steps, which that's is a critical piece for effective restoration beyond the impacts on the ground. So next slide. This is our role in restoration. So this kind of role, so you can just kind of keep pressing on this one. We do revegetation, so lots of planting, you know, implanting and replanting areas that don't have quality habitat. Do biotechnical erosion control type work, so small scale willow walls, check dams and different things to have habitat focused erosion control projects and living erosion control projects. Manage invasive plants in all different ways and different levels. And community engagement, which is a huge piece of what we provide for all of our partnerships, is getting products in the ground in a way that involves community. And then one-stop project management, which includes planning and design, implementation, maintenance, monitoring, and reporting. So next slide. And just real quick, all about partners, right? So just a quick shout out to the different networking events that the Restoration Authority has done. It's a way to get people talking, some that we all know each other for years and some that we don't. And we can all get pretty siloed in our work, right? And in conservation, definitely specific NGOs, government, all different strategies. So these networking sessions allow groups to get together to chat and brainstorm in a really casual and fun way. And these partners are just some examples. Bottom left is Nancy Scolari from the Marin Resource Conservation District, work really closely with RCDs on private land. Top corner is Harold Appleton from Pernesky Chatham, so also work closely with a variety of, you know, ecological design build firms for all of their wonderful expertise. We have Liz Lewis there on top from Marin County Public Works, and just work closely with all different public agencies, flood control, water districts, as well to meet shared goals of community involvement in habitat health. And then Giselle Block from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And in the case of Measure AA, a huge and long partner for us for over 15 years is the Wildlife Refuge System and providing community engagement and transition zone habitat for the refuge complex. And next slide. Just couldn't help myself, picture of Natasha out at a restoration day at San Pablo Bay National Wildlife Refuge. Wonderful, wonderful partner and guide and collaborator as we navigated a, you know, pretty unprecedented couple years of community-based restoration, you know, with the pandemic's impact, which was massive. So thank you, Natasha, for being such a wonderful guide and friend through all this. So next slide. And just to, you know, to focus our work with Measure AA and the Restoration Authority is all the marsh upland transition zone. So that critical habitat from the marsh plain up to where it transitions up to upland habitat. As we know, there aren't a lot of opportunities where it is still a natural transition at the natural grade and, you know, width that was here prior to colonialization and impacting the Bay Edge. Often it is levee edges, but in terms of like wildlife habitat value, especially for our Ridgeways rail and salt marsh harvest mouse, critical, critical habitat as high tide refugia. And building that habitat, you know, transitioning it from, you know, especially in the winter when it's most critical, you know, dead grass and forbs that provide no cover, transitioning it to good cover so these species can persist and survive in high tides and not be easy prey for predators. So next slide. Quick climate change reality check, because it really guides our design work. We can go quickly through this. We know that all the models are indicating a lot more extreme heat days around the Bay Area. This is just one example of a model that's specifically looking at Larkspur, California. So next slide. And, you know, in summary, we know that more frequent and severe extreme events, reduce surface water supply, increase groundwater demand, stream temperatures predicted to go up along with sea level, as well as reduced air quality and potentially increased public safety and health risks associated with all of this. So that's a lot to digest, as we know, and incredible movements and efforts to address these at all different rates around the Bay. In our little corner of this, looking at building habitat that can persist with these challenging predictions, that's what I'll talk about next, is how we look at design for transition zones. And kind of an operating principle that we operate under is this idea of climate smart ecological restoration. And the definition is just that it's a process of enhancing ecological function of degraded or destroyed areas in a manner that makes them more resilient to the consequences of climate change. So it's not just restoring it back to what it was. It's in addition to that, looking at what components we need so that these projects will be resilient and persist regardless of what climate comes our way. So next slide. We have seven principles that we operate under, illustrated here. Show your work, look forward, but don't ignore the past. Consider the broader context, build ecological insurance or redundancy, evolutionary resilience, include the human community, and research and monitor. And as you can imagine, that's a whole nother talk. So I was just going to focus on two today. First being building ecological insurance and redundancy. And we use two tools for this. When we look at our planting designs, this first tool here, we use it to help basically build this idea of ecological, you know, insurance or redundancy. Like a picture we use with our students is, you can imagine an airplane has four engines on it. So if one or even two of them fail, the airplane will still continue to fly. And we look at project designs in the same way. We looked at all different traits that we felt were important for our plants. Can they tolerate full sun, clay soil? Are they evergreen? Are they fire adapted? And then we also, are they resources for wildlife? Do they provide fruit, nectar, you know, seeds, et cetera? And then we also look at all these same plants over when they provide resources along the calendar year, so that we can, you know, to make sure that wildlife have food when they show up at our projects, even if they're migrating a month earlier due to climate change. You know, another analogy we use, this idea of an empty grocery store. We want full grocery stores when our wildlife shows up to these projects. So when we build out a planting design, we factor these all in and make sure we have all of these important traits, all of these calendar, you know, availability of resources, and have multiple plants that provide, you know, that cover all our bases. So even if a third of those projects 100 years from, or plants 100 years from now, can't handle the climate, two thirds of them still can. So we have that redundancy and that insurance. So next slide. In addition to that, we look at all the plants that we work with relative to their ability to persist in future, you know, climate models. And the way we look at that is, for all of the plants that we use that we want to put in a particular project, we have our sea shrimp tool that spatially, so if we click on the map where our project's happening, say if I had a little pointer in the where you're all meeting, I could point to, but say, yeah, thank you. Say we're pointing at San Pablo Bay. We can plug in our plants that we want to put in there. And what this tool does is look at another part of the state where the climate model of what's predicted for San Pablo Bay 100 years from now is the current climate at that other part of the state, and factors in same soil types, rainfall, temperature, as well as evapotranspiration, or the, you know, how much evaporation happens from plants, and see if those plants still persist in those other areas. A classic one for us is often it's looking at either the, you know, the Central Valley or like Napa or Lake County, where the model, the climate there now is, was predicted for closer to the coast. And then we can see if our plants are still living there as well, to give us that information to know, you know, if they're still living in that climate now, odds are pretty high that they'll persist regardless of what climate comes our way. So that's another tool that we use. Next slide. And then to kind of close this out, just, you know, want to share a little bit of thoughts of, you know, how this plays out on the ground. Implementation, this is where it's at. You know, this is, in our case, it's involving community. It's getting these plants out on the ground as effectively and, you know, clearly in terms of instruction as possible. And one really key thing I just wanted to, you know, have this slide for is volunteers can do it if they're trained well, supported, and also have expectations they can do a good job. And so, volunteers, you know, done right, the quality that gets out on the ground is like any other project that happens. So that's this important part to share, is obviously it was very passionate for us. Once the project's in the ground, another key part is establishment work. And that's something that in our experience, we don't see as much as we feel is important for success. That's including weeding, browse protection from wildlife, and irrigation, either from drip, hand water, and other practices that are out there. And in our experience, it's important for a couple reasons. For straight up project success, in the wetland upland transition zone, in our experience, at least 1 year of heavy weeding and irrigation is critical for those plants to get over the hump, really plug in and establish themselves. As exciting as planting days are, for us, it's not not only if you don't do this work, you don't get the same survival that we expect from our projects. It's also not always as respectful to the volunteers themselves if all their hard work is put in and the follow-up's not there. But I want to acknowledge it's definitely a cost, as we all know, for funding these kind of projects. And also one last thing about the importance of established work is the relationship building with the different land managers and landowners. You know, being out there for, you know, sometimes 2-3 years past that and showing that commitment to the work helps galvanizes, help builds more interest and kind of snowballs this work in new regions as we work in new places. So next slide. And the last couple of slides are about monitoring and reporting. And it was interesting to hear the conversation earlier about the interplay from project specific monitoring relative to how that rolls up into regional monitoring and success. And for us, I guess a couple of ways, you know, for our being very much in the project specific side of things, we look at it through two lenses. We look at construction success. Did we build it well? And that for, in our case with plants is percent survival by species. How well the species doing by percent? We look at things like cover as things get grown in, are we meeting our cover goals? And super important for us in terms of adaptive management and phasing projects. And so many places we work on multiple years over multiple phases. And this really informs the improvement of that construction success each year so that we get even better and better. And so then next slide is this idea of validation and functional monitoring though. And that's what's interesting interplay for us with the idea with regional monitoring is even if you build a project well, if nobody's showing up, it's not really meeting the goals of the work, right? So we always make sure we have at least a subset of our sites are getting that validation and function monitoring. And in our case, we look to birds for that, not only because of our history as an organization, but how quickly they respond positive and negatively to restoration. And in the case of habitat, you know, the wetland upland transition zone project, for us, one that's been particularly gratifying is our original work in this habitat type at San Pablo Bay National White Refuge at the old Baylands project, you know, initiated by the Coastal Conservancy so long ago. And the vision of that project's construction combined with, you know, us a lot of work around that wet, you know, that transition zone habitat. You know, it went from zero, you know, breeding pairs of ridge-raised whale now to over 12 was the last count. So that's another example of restoration done right, meeting the goals that we all have for the landscape. So next slide. And then the last one I just want to comment on, and this is mostly just to close this out, is the value and importance of including the human community. So next slide. In our experience and from our perspective, doing projects without the community involved is unfortunate in that the opportunity to build hope, to build connection, to build you know, innovative ideas, bringing different voices into the work, buy-in and support for programs, you know, whether they're, you know, from the voting side of things for funding to supporting, you know, changes in different communities as far as more, you know, people coming and going. Having community involved in every step of the way and seeing their work as a valuable contribution to the larger work, which is exactly what, you know, the point of it all is. It's just a critical piece, and just applaud the Restoration Authority for having this be a key part of the funding programs and RFPs. Because we've seen over our history that the more communities involved and the more that people see that community involvement, it opens a lot of doors and a lot of opportunity for this work to grow and spread. And in particular, in our history, even though we've been fortunate to integrate a lot of different communities in this work, there are a lot that still aren't. And so pushing this from the Restoration Authority level to support the space and time and get as many voices as possible in this will lead to even more successful projects in community on the ground. So thank you for that. And I guess with that, that's what I got. Thank you.